This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Catherine Welch. Colorado voters rejected a pair of funding measures that would have generated billions of dollars for the state's roads and bridges. We dive in to see how much progress lawmakers made before they adjourned.
Marijuana is the only crop in America that has zero federal regulation on pesticide use, leaving states to create their own.
There's a massive amount of confusion, and it's quite chaotic, making it very difficult for growers to understand what they're supposed to do.
We take a peek into how states and cannabis growers learn to navigate the gap in federal oversight.
And later, we take a look into the question, are Americans losing their taste in beer?
I sure hope not.
Plus so much more, including a review from our film critic, Howie Moshevitz.
But first, the juvenile suspect in the STEM school shooting has been charged as an adult facing a first-degree murder charge. KUNC's Lee Patterson reports both suspects appeared in court this week.
The suspects are facing multiple charges in the shooting in Highlands Ranch that left one student dead and eight injured. The adult suspect is also being charged with murder. The court has sealed details of those charges for now. Here's District Attorney George Brockler.
If the court had not sealed or suppressed that portion of the case, I'd have a much more candid conversation with you about numbers, names of charges, sentencing options and ranges.
The next pretrial meetings for both suspects are set for June. Lee Patterson, KUNC.
A Boulder police officer is resigning following a confrontation with a black college student who was picking up trash in his yard.
Boulder police have concluded an investigation on the March 1st incident when officers confronted Zade Atkinson with guns drawn. The investigation found that Officer John Smiley violated two department policies. Smiley resigned before the disciplinary process wrapped up. Boulder police released body camera footage. Here's Atkinson reacting to the officers responding to Smiley's call for backup.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Eight officers of the law with guns drawn on my property. I'm picking up trash for my job.
Boulder police say the process would have likely resulted in suspension or possibly termination. Smiley no longer works for the police department, but remains employed by the city until February of next year. More asylum seekers are expected to make their way to Denver. A group of 55 refugees arrived from New Mexico on Monday. Their arrival is part of an effort to house a flood of newly released asylum seekers.
The New Mexico governor's office says immigration authorities have released more than 3,000 asylum seekers in the small town of Las Cruces since mid-April. When local shelters hit capacity, the governor worked with a network of nonprofit organizations to bring the refugees to Denver, where they could be temporarily housed before traveling to meet their sponsors. Claudia Tristan with the New Mexico governor's office says as the influx of asylum seekers continues, they're hoping to shuttle a group per week to Denver.
People are tired. Resources are getting low within the nonprofit community and the NGOs. And if we can get assistance from great communities like Denver, then we are going to do whatever we can to help.
In March, U.S. Border Patrol said they had seen an unprecedented number of migrants, mostly families of unaccompanied children. Due to the lack of space in the system, they've had to release people and say not all are asylum seekers.
Broomfield City Council approved the first reading of a six-month moratorium on oil and gas operations. The Denver Post reports the temporary freeze is aimed at allowing city officials time to update local ordinances in response to Senate Bill 181. The new law gives local governments more authority over oil and gas operations. During the moratorium, oil and gas operations in Broomfield will be on hold until November 14th. The second reading is scheduled for later this May. Six months and one legislative session have gone by, and they've been a doozy.
Colorado voters rejected a pair of funding measures that would have generated billions of dollars for the state's roads and bridges. So, how much progress was made before the General Assembly adjourned? And how are advocates reacting? KUNC's Scott Franz has more.
Lawmakers took two steps they hope will make driving around the state smoother. In April, they struck a bipartisan deal to increase road funding by $70 million. Representative Danaya Escar announced the deal to 40 of her fellow Democrats.
That brings this year's total to $300 million to transportation.
A few weeks later, Democrats approved a measure that would ask voters to end the state revenue limit set by the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, or Tabor Amendment. If approved, the state could get anywhere from $65 million to $1 billion annually that would otherwise get refunded to taxpayers. House Speaker Casey Becker says some of it would go to roads and bridges.
We don't think that this is going to be a solution to long-term needs in transportation and higher ed or K-12, but we think it's a really good first step.
The measure had some bipartisan support, including Republican Senator Kevin Priola.
Depending on how you slice it, we're looking at a $7 billion structural deficit with projects, and it's not pleasant to drive around here anymore.
But during his first State of the State address, Governor Jared Polis promised something bigger.
We need to come together around a bipartisan funding mechanism to meet our current and future transportation needs that the voters of this state will accept and will continue to help our economy grow and Colorado to prosper.
In April, I asked him if he'd found that funding solution.
We've convened a fiscal working group. We've had several meetings, four or five multi-stakeholder meetings. Kerry Kennedy, our chief fiscal strategist, helps convene those. I've attended either all of them or almost all of them as well, with a broad group of folks from across the state who representing schools, representing roads and bridges, business community, and others. And that group will continue to meet on building as large a coalition as possible to meet our infrastructure funding needs.
In other words, not yet. I also reached out to Shoshana Liu, the new director of the Colorado Department of Transportation, or CDOT, to talk about the bigger picture. Have you been involved with these conversations about a potential, you know, long-term funding solution?
There is absolutely a kind of broad conversation about fiscal issues going on, you know, that I'm a part of, that many of the key transportation stakeholders across the state are a part of. But, you know, I also think that part of the challenge is to get the conversation about transportation away from sort of just big numbers with a lot of zeros, you know, and I say this as a former CFO that, you know, we have a tendency to sort of approach the challenges of transportation from the perspective of kind of large sums of money that are so big that they're almost hard to comprehend for the average person, right? And, you know, when you have to ultimately go to voters, you know, for solutions, it has to be translated into something that means things to their lives, right?
But outside of the Capitol, those who have spent years asking lawmakers for more money for transportation are giving this session mixed reviews.
Some of the new dollars that were identified this session are a little bit of a drop in the bucket.
Margaret Bowes leads the I-70 Coalition, a group focused on improving travel through the mountains. One of the projects she's advocating for is a renovation and expansion of Floyd Hill. The price tag is $500 million.
The Joint Budget Committee found $100 million from the general fund, and that's great, but that gets us less than one-fifth of the way to a project like Floyd Hill.
On the other hand, Sandra Hagan Solon is pleased with the progress made by lawmakers. Solon is head of Fix Colorado Roads.
In northern Colorado, we anticipate some dollars flowing into North I-25 to assure a full funding of certain segments of that corridor between Fort Collins and Loveland.
While the extra $70 million won't fund the bigger needs, she says it brings the state's total investment to about $750 million this year. But in the final week of the session, lawmakers postponed a ballot question that sought to borrow $2.3 billion for transportation. Democratic Senator Rachel Zenzinger feared it would compete with the Tabor question, also seeking money for roads.
When you have two measures on the ballot, both in favor of transportation, you doom them to failure.
I'm Scott Franz at the State Capitol.
Ten states have legalized recreational marijuana, giving way to a thriving industry, even though federal government still outlaws it. And without federal rules, states are left to come up with their own pesticide regulations. KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig has more.
It's unlike any other crop in America. The EPA has done zero testing to determine which pesticides are safe for consumers, and no federally funded programs can teach these farmers how to effectively combat pests. Depending on which state you're in, cannabis growers are largely on their own.
How marijuana growers learn best practices is on the internet, and it's a scary place. It's
awful.
Whitney Cranshaw is an entomologist at Colorado State University.
In terms of pest management advice, I have never seen so much gross misinformation, so much junk science, so much silliness.
He often consults commercial farmers on eradicating tricky pests. But because cannabis is still federally illegal, he's not allowed to work with it.
It drives me nuts. And you could make more progress in terms of helping people by providing information on these crops than anything that I've ever worked with.
In Colorado, cannabis farmers have some guidance. Using existing EPA research, state officials have created a list of more than 300 pesticides that they're allowed to use. It's basically a workaround to the gap in federal research because these products are so low in toxins, they can be used on virtually any crop, and they don't leave behind harmful residues. Still, Colorado marijuana growers are caught using pesticides they're not supposed to. Last year, there were 22 cases.
Feels almost tropical in here. That's nice.
It's very humid.
Cynthia Anderson and her husband have run this grow operation in Denver since medical marijuana was legalized almost a decade ago. Inside, it's a wash of bright lights, oscillating fans, and about 450 green marijuana plants. It's small for the industry, but it means Anderson can give each plant individual attention.
Since we look at our plants every day, you know, if she turns a different color, or if she turns yellow, or if she's not getting enough water, or she's getting too much light, that's something that, you know, you pay attention to on a daily basis, and you can do that. Can you do that with 50,000? No.
Pests like spider mites or powdery mildew will decimate a crop of cannabis, which is why growers like Anderson rely on pesticides. But if you're caught using a pesticide that's not approved by the state, officials will take away your products, fine you up to $2,000, and even shut down your business. Anderson says rumors circulate within the industry that not everyone follows the rules.
We hear about the horror stories at other grows and what is done and what isn't done.
Anderson thinks growers might risk using an unapproved pesticide if a pest problem gets out of control and they need something stronger to take care of it.
They don't have any choice but to use that to get rid of whatever it is that their plants have. You're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars of growing plants that are their potential income.
The Department of Agriculture would only share 4 of the 22 misuse cases from last year. The entomologist, Cranshaw, says the unapproved pesticides they listed in those cases are common and not especially harmful. He thinks these growers could have just made a mistake.
There's a massive amount of confusion, and it's quite chaotic, making it very difficult for growers to understand what they're supposed to do.
Growers are still held to the same federal worker protection standards when applying pesticides. But in one case, workers were not given respirators to apply a certain pesticide. In another, a worker reported his employer to the state for pouring pesticides down the storm drain. The department's John Scott says things have only improved since the state started regulating pesticides in the marijuana industry 4 years ago.
I will say that, you know, we've seen a dramatic increase in compliance.
While some states have no regulations in place, Washington, Oregon, and Nevada follow a similar model as Colorado. Illinois, which may pass recreational marijuana this spring, will likely follow a similar one. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
You can find the other stories in our pesticide series at KUNC.org. It feels like summer is here despite the avalanches and spring snow. What are you looking forward to as the temperatures warm up in the state, Catherine?
Oh, I look forward to getting in a raft or a tube and hitting the rivers.
That sounds like a really good time. You should talk to Luke. I think I'm super excited to check out the Breckenridge Troll, who finally seems like he's here to stay.
We're all overwhelmed by how much love and the relationships that were actually built with this sculpture by our community members. So I think all of us realized that it was important that this not be the end of Isaac's story.
We hear more about Isaac Hartstone in just a little bit.
But before we get to that, this might be a surprise, but Americans seem to be losing their taste for beer.
That just can't be true.
I know. Well, it just might be. The dizzying growth in the microbrew industry is slowing down. Craft beer producers are trying to buck this trend. And as Maggie Mullen reports for KUNC, that involves figuring out how to be competitive with each other and the newer kid on the block, craft spirits.
Mike Mosier's job is to know what people are drinking and what they aren't.
And people are generally drinking a lot better now. They're not drinking cheap for the most part.
Mosier's with the Wyoming State Liquor Association.
Where the real drop is in premium beer categories, Budweiser, Coors, etc. They've been down every year for a while.
Down by almost 10% in sales since 2010. And Mosier says brand loyalty has also changed.
In my father's era or my grandfather's era, they started with a Schlitz in their hand and a bottle of 10 High whiskey, and they died with it in their hand. That's all they drank.
Millennials are different, he says. Younger generations might have favorite brands, but they also want to try out what's new. And when it comes to craft beer, there's a lot to choose from.
If everybody's got an IPA, why is your IPA going to catch the consumer's eye?
At Worldworks Brewing in Greeley, Colorado, they're thinking about this all the time. Steve Froome is one of their taproom servers. He hands me a taster of a murky-looking beer.
This beer we released on our first anniversary, and since then it has launched us in a trajectory upwards.
Whoa. I don't think I've had an IPA that tastes like that.
Isn't that good?
The beer is called Juicy Bits.
It's almost like adult Kool-Aid.
It's a hazy or New England-style IPA, which means its flavor is softer and more citrusy. This style of beer has blown up over the last year or so, and this particular brew has a reputation for being really delicious amongst beer drinkers. And Froome says those beer drinkers are coming from all over to try it.
Within the first 3 months of me working here, I probably saw 45 plus of the different state IDs.
But Weldworks still has their work cut out for them. Like a lot of places, you can't walk a few city blocks in the Rocky Mountains without running into a brewery. So on top of tasting good, catchy names and labels, producers are thinking about how their product is perceived. Eric Krasonic is a professor in the marketing department at the University of Wyoming.
Studies have shown that people are willing to pay more. They're willing to pay a premium, even on everyday products such as beer, if that product is perceived as being good to its employees as well as the environment.
Krasonic says in the beer world, this employee-centered approach was pioneered by the Colorado-based New Belgium Brewery, the maker of beers like Fat Tire and Voodoo Ranger. And it worked for them.
I think you can't separate a company's culture from how it's perceived in the marketplace. You have incredibly educated consumers.
Neighboring breweries like Weldworks paid attention. For example, all Weldworks full-time employees get health insurance, paid time off, and continued education. It also followed New Belgium's lead in distributing its beer outside of the local market. Still, despite all these efforts, craft brewing seems to be slowing down. Meanwhile, crafted distilled spirits are having a moment.
Craft spirits right now are pretty much following the same trajectory that craft beer did.
That's Chad Pollock. He and his family own and operate Backwards Distilling in Casper, Wyoming.
You know, with the craft beer market, I think it took some people by surprise. So I think craft spirits, people are hopping on a little quicker.
Last year, the number of active craft distilleries in the U.S. grew by over 15%.
And I think the most fun part about craft distilling, I think, is coming up in the next 5 years when people start making interesting products.
That means more than just your standard vodka, gin, or whiskey.
And that's probably going to be the future of standing out, is making things that are kind of strange.
Like sour cherry gin, smoky tequila, or cinnamon moonshine. And remember Mike Mosier, the guy whose job it is to know what people are drinking? He sees current trends continuing.
Well, I'll look in my liquor crystal ball.
What he sees is beer sales continuing to dip and spirits continuing to rise. And he says the beverage that comes out on top might not even give you a buzz.
Also, a huge market that's growing is non-alcoholic. I have a number of friends, I'm sure you have a number of friends, that don't drink alcohol, but like to go to bars because bars are fun.
Either way, Mosier says it's a good time to be a customer, just maybe without the beer. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Maggie Mullen.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration. You can find more stories at KUNC.org.
Last summer, a new resident came to Breckenridge. He was creative, environmentally friendly, and popular. Maybe a little too popular. KUNC's Stacy Nick has the story.
Step off the beaten path near Breckenridge's Illinois Gulch, and you're likely to find an unexpected sight. Tucked away amid a cluster of trees is a construction crew building a large wooden structure The 15-foot-tall sculpture depicts a friendly troll made of scrap wood. He's named Isaac Heartstone after the heart-shaped stone placed on his chest as a finishing touch.
You like that sound? My name is Thomas Dambo. I'm a Danish artist currently here in Breckenridge, Colorado. And I am known for making a big interactive recycled art project that involves the local community and teaches people about the importance of recycling and all the possibilities that lays in our trash.
Dambo is also known for his trolls. There are more than 50 of them in locations all over the world. He says the trolls are a way of using interactive art to represent scale.
Because us humans are really small compared to a troll, and we're also really small compared to nature.
But last fall, scale became a big problem for Dambo and the town of Breckenridge. You see, this isn't Dambo's first time here. Last spring, the artist was on the other side of town building the first Isaac Heartstone as part of the Breckenridge International Festival of Arts. Dambo's work was a perfect fit for the festival, says curator Nicole Dial Kay, and a real draw for audiences who maybe weren't the usual art or outdoors crowd.
Especially with works like Thomas Dambo's Isaac Heartstone, we saw so many people that don't hike, that don't go out into nature, that were making that journey, that were seeing a different side of Colorado.
Isaac was a resounding success, and the idea was that the giant installation would remain up until Mother Nature decided otherwise. But then word got out, and that's when the trouble started. Instead of visitations trailing off with the end of the summer season, Isaac went viral, thanks in part to photos of him all over social media. Breckenridge spokesperson Haley Littleton says each week, thousands continue to flock to town to see the troll, inundating a nearby residential neighborhood with traffic and trash.
We did throw a lot of resources out there. We set up some fence and railing. We put a lot of signage out there. We added some trash cans. We increased our bus routes. We also put some of our police officers up there to manage traffic.
Nothing seemed to help, and soon there'd be another problem. Winter was coming.
Essentially, you know, winter is our big season. It's very busy in the ski area, and we realized that a lot of our resources we were going to have to pull back down into town.
So Isaac had to go. But when the sculpture was taken down, people got mad, really mad. Even people who didn't live in Breckenridge, or Colorado for that matter. Curator Nicole Dial Kay says no one expected Isaac to become such an important member of the community.
We were all overwhelmed by how much love and the relationships that were actually built with this sculpture by our community members. So I think all of us realized that it was important that this not be the end of Isaac's story.
The Trolling Forward Task Force was established to find a better, safer location for the installation. According to town spokesperson Haley Littleton, like most things, the problem with Isaac was really all about location.
We wanted to find a place that still felt like an adventure, but was close to town. It was easily accessible by biking, walking, by the bus, and that was close to facilities. And so we settled on this area, the Illinois Gulch area, by the ice rink.
Now Isaac's home is a little less remote. Still under construction, the Trollstigen Trail, named for a road in Norway known as Troll Road, will be what Littleton calls a social trail. Built just for Isaac, the half-mile one-way route will loop visitors right past him.
I think we learned a lot in this whole process.
It's also been a lesson for artist Thomas Dambo.
Of course, it was sad to see the old sculpture being taken down, but also, as an artist, what more can you wish for than so many people come to visit your and view your art, so it becomes a problem.
Now, visitors will be able to see Dambo's work again, although Breckenridge officials want people to know there's no need to rush to visit Isaac Heartstone's new location. This time, they say, he's not going anywhere. Stacy Nick, KUNC, Breckenridge.
While Isaac Heartstone is now settled in his new location, he's still off limits to the public while the path to get to him is completed. The new trail is expected to open in early June.
A lot has been written in the last 50 years about the murders of seven people by the followers of cult leader Charles Manson. Charlie Says is a new film based on a book by Mary Harron. KUNC film critic Howie Movchevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says it's a tender and brilliant movie.
Mary Harron's Charlie Says centers on three of the women from the Manson gang in prison in California, long after they've committed those horrendous murders. Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Susan Atkins live in cells on death row as the film begins, not because they're to be executed, but because the prison doesn't know how else to segregate them from the rest of the inmates. The movie's based on a book by Carlene Faith, a teacher who comes to the prison to work with the young women, and the story's built out of their conversations with Faith, played by Merritt Weaver, along with their memories of their time at the Spahn Movie Ranch, an old film location outside of Los Angeles. Charlie Says takes an astonishing look at how people can be warped. Even years later, the women, played by Hannah Murray, Sosie Bacon, and Marianne Rendon, are bizarrely naive and blank in the eyes and in their speech. They still quote Manson constantly. They explain what they think they learned on the ranch by saying, "Charlie says," and "Charlie says." And even though the film shows their shift from 1960s free love and hippie disdain for middle-class life, you wonder how it all led to murder. Manson, played by snake-eyed Matt Smith, has the lunatic's genius for finding and dominating vulnerable people. For the young women he collects, he's mesmerizing, and he has the patience for slowly bringing them along. As one young woman on the ranch says to a newcomer, "We don't get hung up about sex, we just be. We let things happen." It might sound like a prescription for freedom, but it also marks astonishing passivity. Charlie lectures to his disciples, assembled like schoolchildren in front of him. Middle-class parents, he says, train their children to have cookie-cutter minds. These things sounded like great truths to middle-class kids at the time, and the genius of the movie is how well Mary Harron, from Guinevere Turner's script, has the patience to show the slow creep of Manson's influence. By the campfire, Charlie says, "Take off your clothes for us, Sandy." Sandy looks stricken, but she has no will to resist as the others undress her. This is standard cult manipulation. Charlie even says that he wants to destroy egos. But of course not his own ego. And he mostly wants pliant women around him, but has little interest in the few men who hang around. One of the events that sets him off, and may have led directly to the murders, is when he's persuaded a music producer to come listen to him sing his own songs. They're dreadful, his guitar playing's worse, and his topless backup singers out there in the open on the Spahn Ranch look pathetic. The producer is Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day, and Melcher's rejection sends Manson into a vindictive and finally murderous rage. But the great moment in a film of remarkable insight and care for damaged women comes when the teacher finally interrupts the litany of Charlie Says and Charlie Says and asks directly, "But what do you think?" Faith's question stymies the women as if she's just ripped away their core beliefs. They look lost, as if they will never find themselves again. She's also just shaken them with the news that human beings cannot grow wings and become elves. Charlie Says draws the best portrait of a cult I've seen in film. Filmmakers usually seem afraid to show how groups like this actually look and operate. They dress it up and soften the picture into mush. But Mary Harron looks right into the Manson family and shows it for its twisted, mindless, and malicious banality. For KUNC, I'm Howie Movchevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with the support from our KUNC members.
Thank you.
If you're not yet a member, join now with a tax-deductible contribution at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Catherine Welch, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.